How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Corey Clark.
Welcome back, everybody. Hope you're doing well. You're staying healthy and having a good time getting ready for Thanksgiving. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. And in just a little bit, we are going to be talking to Catherine Blake. And full disclosure, I don't know Catherine well, but I know her husband well, and I know her in-laws very well. And Catherine has written a book called The Uninnocent, which is a really personal and compassionate and provocative book about violence and the criminal justice system, about which one of our pals tonight knows something, and forgiveness. Really, really interesting, really thought-provoking. I needed to read it a couple of times. But we've got Claude Jennings doing the important work, get David Aldridge back. I need to talk to Michael Sands about a delivery that David's supposed to be getting the next week or so. Yeah. Oh. It's overdue. And we're welcoming back one of the, I believe, Kyle Swenson, you were one of the original 20, the top 20 on Chatter on Books back in the day when we actually taped this in a real restaurant.
One of the OGs. Yeah.
Welcome back.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. This is cool.
You've got a pandemic beard. You didn't have that last time we saw you.
No. Yeah. This is a pandemic beard. It's also, I tore my Achilles. So I've been sitting on the couch because I had surgery a couple weeks back. So it's that as well. So I'm glad we're not on TV, but yeah. So I've got the mangy beard going.
Sports related injury.
I hesitate to say yes, because I was playing tennis, but I don't actually play tennis. I was kind of hitting tennis balls around, maybe thinking, oh, this would be a cool thing to maybe this would be my new thing. And then pretty shortly,
your Achilles said no.
My career was over. Yeah. In tennis. So.
How's the career been going during the pandemic? How's it impacted you?
It's been difficult. You know, at the Washington Post, I cover inequality now. So obviously the pandemic has upended so many people's lives and injected so much uncertainty, not only on the avenue of, you know, health, but also like, can people pay their bills? Are they going to be evicted? Do they have enough food to eat? So it's really been eye-opening, and it's really been, there's a seriousness to it that I think is to the work that's very apparent, because we're in these monumental times, and you know, every day you kind of realize it and see people being impacted by it.
Is it a cliche? I'm sure it's a cliche, because that's all I know is cliches. A cliche to say the pandemic has exposed a lot of inequities in society?
It has, but I think those inequities were already there. You know,
they were definitely there, but not many people paid attention to them, especially if you're living in Chevy Chase, Maryland. You're like,
absolutely. Yeah. You know, this was the kick that knocked over the house of cards, I think. But yeah. I think what we realized is how many people were really in a fragile situation. And, you know, I don't know how long it's going to take for some folks to get out of it. You know, we hear the economy is coming back in some ways, but then you go to the gas station and see how high prices are. And you figure that if you're a struggling family, can you really afford to keep filling up your gas tank?
River Road, almost $4.
Crazy.
Absolutely crazy. Which is, I just stopped my car and said, that's it. Not going anywhere. I just refuse to pay that. Okay, let me ask a question about you, your coverage, and what happens to you when you write about, I saw you writing something about Manchin recently.
Right,
and
yes.
Manchin is just a hot button in the political world these days. So when you write about Manchin and you write about the accompanying stories about inequality and inequities, et cetera, is the feedback you get from readers more polarized, more hyped than it has been in years past? Is this something new, a different experience for you as a reporter?
Well, I've been a reporter through, you know, the Trump era at the Washington Post, which was a time when
has it ended? Are we still?
Yeah. Well, I will say that one thing is that I do feel that there's more sense of a shared kind of national trauma and national tough times going on. Like, I feel like everyone kind of understands that people are afraid or struggling, especially a year ago. I think that's like lessons. So the Manchin thing, you know, that was about people struggling and people who are going to lose the child tax credit, which Manchin didn't want to extend in this bill.
Right.
And so we went to West Virginia and talked to the people in his state who were benefiting from it. And it was real eye-opening. And you know, you always get those emails which call you the
the enemy of the people and, you know, a traitor and a commie and, communist. You know, fill in the blank. That's the easy part. You know, that's the light touch. And I fear that that's just going to be the way it is for a long time. I feel that's, that's the line.
But it doesn't bother you when you get those kinds of emails? It doesn't bother you?
No, no. I mean, I used to, because I used to think like, hey guy, because it's usually a guy on an it's usually a guy on an iPad somewhere. and, you know, I said, what if I called your work or sent you an email at your work saying you do terrible, you know, you're terrible at your job as an accountant. You know, I called you your accountant firm, for example. But over time, I just realized that people just blow off steam and they, it's just kind of a part of the job now, which is unfortunate.
David, have you gotten used to it?
Yeah, you get used to it. I mean, you people understand.
People who follow sports and watch you on all your many, many appearances.
You know, I mean, it's hard to say what the breakdown is, but, you know, most sports fans are very rational, reasonable, and will listen. And then, you know, there's that percentage that don't listen and won't listen and wants you to, you know, put on a skirt and pom-poms and cheer for the local team. And you try to explain to them that's not what you do. It's not the job. And it's worse in college towns. If you have a college team that's very, I mean, the poor people that had to cover Penn State during the end of Paterno, oh my goodness.
You know,
it was awful. So yeah, you get used to it. Doesn't mean you like it, but you get used to it.
Yeah. Okay. From sublime to the ridiculous, David.
Yes.
I'm gonna have to say this carefully because it's kind of a family podcast, but not really. WTF about the WFT.
Yeah, you can say it. It's fine.
Holy cow, man.
You've all made that joke.
Okay. Sorry. It's not a
joke. No. It's an understandable joke to make. Sure.
I was pretty obsessed with F1 this weekend because it was a very big weekend for F1. And we'll spend the next 20 minutes talking about that.
You've got to get me into this obsession you have with
F1. Oh, my God. Okay. 30-second. Kyle, have you watched the Netflix series Drive to Survive?
No, I haven't.
Okay. You've got to do it. Just stop everything. Get off the show and go watch it.
Because everyone's looking for binge stuff. I feel like now everyone's done it all. We've all watched everything and now we're looking for...
Of all the binging I've done during the pandemic, and David and Claude know this, I've done a lot. The best ever. And here's all you need to know about how incredible this series is. The diversity of people who have become addicted to F1 because of the series. So it's my 20-something kids. It's me and my husband. It's my friends down the street who are in their mid-70s. And I told them about this a couple of weeks ago. And they started watching. They called me yesterday afternoon to say, did you watch the race into Brazil? Did you see what Lewis Hamilton did? It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And every other, you know, poor marketing PR bastard working in every other sport is going, God, why didn't we think of that? It's the best. It's the best. Okay. But anyways, while I was surfing through the, you know, feedback on the Brazil race, David, I just come across Washington versus Tampa Bay and I go right by and I literally stopped and went, wait a minute, what did I just see? And I went back and I saw the score and said, WTF.
We all did in the press box.
What happened? Were you there?
Of course I was there. I wrote
about it. God bless you. The FedEx field. Ugh.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. They played well. Tampa did not. And that's, you know, that's kind of what the NFL is designed to do.
Yeah.
You know, there's scarcity at quarterback, but pretty much everywhere else there isn't. You know, everybody has some good linemen, some good receivers, some good running backs. But the difference is quarterback, right? And so obviously Tampa's got the best of all time in Tom Brady and Washington does not. But for whatever reason, Tom Brady did not play that well yesterday, one of his rare off days. And Washington's quarterback, Taylor Heinicke, played exceptional. It was terrific.
Great.
And that was essentially the difference in the game to me. I mean,
Tom Brady. I'm in the tank for Tom Brady. He didn't have Gronkowski. He didn't have Antonio Brown, right?
Very true. No, that's all true. They were banged up, but so was Washington. You know, it's an NFL team. Everybody's got injuries and significant ones. And Washington lost their premier young draft pick for the season yesterday to a torn ACL.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody's banged up this time of year. And so was Tampa Bay, but so was Washington, and Washington still outplayed them yesterday, period.
Stunning, stunning. It's a good football weekend for this family. Michigan beat Penn State. Hate Penn State anyhow, but son went to Michigan, so that was a good one. And then it was a real family crisis because, Kyle, you don't know this, but I went to NC State. One of our kids went to Wake Forest. And Wake Forest is having a very good year.
Yeah.
Shockingly, something's wrong with the Stars alignment year. Good year. And Wake won 45-42.
Wow.
Nobody in North Carolina can play defense, seemingly. But I was happy for him. Sad for me, but happy for me. And then the Caps had a great game last night.
Caps killed the Penguins. They're arch rivals, right?
Great game.
Yeah. Killed the Penguins. Okay, I have a little bit of news, and we have to pretend to talk about books. The first part of the news is not in the top 20 like Kyle Swenson, probably in our middle, like close to 100 shows. Robert P. Jones Jr., who wrote a fabulous book called The Prophets.
Yes.
Incredible, magical book about a Black queer love story on a plantation. Just incredible. And he is a finalist now for the National Book Awards, which will be announced on Wednesday, the 17th. So fingers crossed for him. We're very happy about that. And then, because we love to brag about our Chatter alum, Maggie Shipstead, Great Circle, Donnie Walton, the final revival of Opal and Nev, and Sean Crosby from Razorblade Tears, all got named as Best of 2021 Fiction by Kirkus Reviews. So we're very happy
all
for them.
Outstanding.
Yeah. Kyle, do you have another book in the pipeline?
I don't. Nothing. Some vague ideas. Someday. Yeah. Someday I'll move on one of them. But it's just been, you know, it's been a crazy year. And I've just been real tied up in my work at the paper and life. And one day I definitely will, though.
If you won the lottery and it wasn't about money, you had all the time in the world, what would you write about? Just because you would really enjoy it, not because it necessarily had to sell 180 million copies like Ken Follett sells.
Oh my gosh. There's some, I have an idea and it's been done, but I would love to do, like, I'm fascinated by Orson Welles. And I think like an Orson Welles bio, you know, would be, I know they're out there, but I just think that he's such an interesting figure. And I recently heard a podcast about the War of the Worlds broadcast, which I knew the vague outlines of, but didn't know all the details of, and just thought it was fascinating. So something like that, maybe, you know, I'm not
That'd
sure.
be cool.
Yeah.
David, you win the lottery. You have all the time in the world. Your kids are launched. They're out of college. You have no worries. You have a dog, a Yorkshire Terrier. What do you write about?
No, I don't know. I have ideas that I can't talk about because I want to keep them to myself and write about them someday. The book, well, I told my agent this one time. He said, you're an absolute idiot. I'm sure I've mentioned this before during the podcast. There was a television network that was concurrent with ABC and CBS and NBC that nobody remembers called Dumont. Nobody remembers.
Called what?
Dumont. Like the paint people, Dumont.
Yeah. You know?
In fact, I think the paint people may have had ownership of that network. But Dumont was the first network that broadcast professional football games, NFL games.
Wow.
They did it before anybody else. They sold television sets before anybody else. They had all these kind of innovative because they had to be, they were the fourth network. Otherwise nobody would watch them. They did all these interesting, crazy things. I think Ernie Kovacs may have started on the Dumont network. I'm trying to remember, but I would love to do a book on that. That's how weird and strange I am.
I think that'd be fascinating.
And why it didn't work and what did work and why, you know, some people should remember them. It was different. It was like Fox without Fox.
I think it'd be fascinating. And those kinds of books, you can always, it can be about that, but it also becomes a social commentary.
Yeah.
Right? Scott Price wrote a book that was ostensibly about high school football outside Pittsburgh, but it really wasn't.
Right.
It wasn't.
Sure.
It was about so many other things.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure they set the template for a lot of stuff that other networks picked up on and people went on. I bet it would be I'd read that book.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's when we win the lot. When I win the lottery, I will share.
Okay. Wait. What are you writing a book about if you win the lottery?
I wrote a book, David, and it was so bad and it was so tragic and the experience was so searing. Never again. It's like you've jumped off the San Francisco Bay Bridge. You go, this was a bad idea. You land, somehow you survive. And you go, never going to do that again.
No, it was not that bad.
Ever. Yeah, no. No, every time I read a book, somebody that we have on the show, and then I read another book during the week and other things, and I go, oh my God, these people are brilliant and creative and really good writers. And no, can't do that. Okay. So this is a topic about which I will stutter and stammer more than I usually do, because it's all about, can you, should you even try to separate the artist and their work from their behavior as a person? And we all know about, we figured out the half of the, or more of the founding fathers were slave owners. So we don't like them completely because of that. We know that. But there was a column in the New York Times recently, and it was written by a woman named Jennifer Finney Boylan. It got me thinking about this again. And she presents the question, is it okay to love the music, say, of Don McLean, even though it turns out he was really horrible to his wife and these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And we know about Eric Clapton and his,
yes,
you know, just racist rants and these kinds of things. You know, I say all the time, I feel guilty that I love Michael Jackson, and I just make myself separate my love for his music from that. But should we do that? Or should we say, you know what, there are enough performers and authors and celebrities out there doing amazing things. Should we forgive people for these things? Or do we say, no, not, you're not being forgiven. We can't separate you. We work. David?
Well, it's obviously impossible, and it's obviously wholly subjective, right? I mean, everybody has their lines of demarcation past which they will not go. You know, up until about a decade ago, Bill Cosby was revered, right? He was revered. He was the funniest, one of the funniest people who ever walked the earth. Everyone loved him. Yeah. He was universally loved across all races, across all genders, and now he's not. Right. And so does that mean that, you know, his bits aren't funny anymore? I don't know. I'm not smart enough to be able to make that distinction. I think I liked Louis C.K. early in my, you know, a few years ago, but he was very funny and honest about race, for example, in a way that few people try to be, and said things that could be viewed as provocative, but I thought were actually kind of spot on. And now you can't like Louis C.K. And you're seeing a lot of this with Dave Chappelle now, same thing. So
yeah,
comedians are different. I know they're different from musicians because comedians kind of are kind of engineered to kind of go to the line and cross it and cross over it again and be provocative and all those things. Musicians tend not to be quite as provocative, but I just read, had to be, I don't know, 6,000 words last night and Rolling Stone and Marilyn Manson.
Yeah,
I read that too.
A horrible human being. He treated people terribly. But I mean, I'm not a Marilyn Manson fan, but I know he's got millions of followers. What do you do with that? I don't know.
And Keith Richards. Okay, I'll shut up in a second, Kyle. Keith Richards, whom I revere the Rolling Stones, and I revere Keith Richards. And my dog's formal name is Keith Richards. And he doesn't really understand why the Rolling Stones decided to pull from their playlist Brown Sugar. Doesn't really understand, like, oh, you know? But Kyle, what do you think? Can you separate the artist from the material?
Like David said, I don't know. I think it's a difficult conversation. You know, I think that what is inspiring, though, is that we're having the conversation, though. Like, I think that these conversations are actually, like, really interesting and important. And I'm not sure. My point is that I think that when the work becomes the cover of the shield for bad behavior, I think that that's a really important distinction. Michael Jackson is a good example of that. You know, you know, these types of things that seem to have gone on. Marilyn Manson also, I read that Rolling Stone article as well. We're like, our fame adoration seems to be giving these people a protective covering, and we forget that they're just people, you know, they're as flawed as anybody else. Right. So I think, having these conversations are really important. I was never a big Don McLean fan to begin with.
It made it easier for me too. I was like, who cares?
But Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson's a great one.
I'm never not going to love Thriller and Off the Wall and Bad. I mean, they're great albums.
Yeah. Okay.
But so I know he was a pedophile. I know it. I mean, it's not right. I mean, what do you do with that? I don't know what to do with those two incongruent things that are both true.
I think there's a line too. I think there's a line though between like having opinions that seem less enlightened and maybe are kind of not what we say anymore, and like criminal acts, you know, obviously, and like violence. I think that's really important to make those lines.
That helps me. I'm serious. I have trouble thinking through these things all the time, and that is, there's a difference between words and actions. So the latest one in the crosshairs, God bless him, is Charles Dickens. And evidently in his hometown, wherever it is, some tiny town over there, somebody put graffiti all over one of the museums, you know. And Charles Dickens for many years revered for bringing attention to the plight of the poor and the impoverished and those kinds of things. He also wrote pretty extensively about saying horrible things about the people in the colonies that his country was colonizing. And so he's being reconfigured in all this. But Kyle, I kind of picked up on something you just said. And I'm not kidding. I stutter and stumble with this, but it doesn't make me think less of their work. It makes me think more comprehensively about them and their place in society and their work, which is not, you know, I got time. I can think more than, you know, one thought at a time. So, okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. I think it's difficult. Okay. Now we're going to talk to a really smart person, and David and I will shut up, Kyle, and you're going to have to talk.
Oh gosh.
Catherine Blake,
welcome. We're finishing this for the next 20 minutes. Don't mind
exactly. me. Catherine Blake, welcome to Chatter on Books.
Thank you for having me, Tori.
Thanks for joining us. As I said a little bit earlier, Catherine, I kind of know you. I've gotten to know you a lot better in the last few weeks talking about this. Yeah. I know your husband pretty well. I've known him since he was a young man. Yeah. And I know your in-laws pretty well. Yeah. Catherine, The Uninnocent, your book, is really something. And I always, in the week or so leading up to a show, I always find myself talking to people and walking the dogs. And people go, what are you up to? Who's on the show? And I just say, it's so personal, it's so compassionate, and it's so provocative. Mm-hmm. The Uninnocent is pretty remarkable, and we will talk a lot about it, but on Chatter, we'd like to talk a little bit about the author. Mm-hmm. And we've had many people who were either lawyers and they became writers, or they thought they wanted to be lawyers, and then mm-hmm. they sidetracked to become an astronaut, and then they became a writer. You're one of the few people we've had on the show. You actually came from a literary family, right?
I did, yeah.
Tell us about that. What was that like growing up?
Yeah, both my parents are writers. My mom is a poet, and she also wrote 3 mystery novels. And my dad is a novelist.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did they make you read a lot as a little kid, or did you like to read a lot?
Good question. I don't think that they made me read. I did like to read. It was funny. I learned to read really late. Like I had dyslexia. Uh-huh. And so I struggled with reading and had to see a specialist. And I'm still a really, really slow reader. And my mom's, the fastest reader. She reads voraciously. But when I did finally learn to read, I think it was, I loved it with my whole self. Like I would spend whole days, under the blanket with a flashlight, like pretending the sun wasn't out and reading, YA novels. I definitely love to read. And our house was full of books. Like that's probably one of the greatest gifts that my parents gave me is that.
Okay. We're going to get Kyle and David's childhood reading experience, but I'll tell you mine.
Yeah.
My parents, God bless them, very serious people. My father, very serious. My obnoxious older sisters, brilliant. Anyways, reading classics all the time. And in my house, it was frowned upon if you were reading something that was not serious. And all I cared about was horses. And all I wanted to read was horse books. And I would sit in bed at night and I would have, Great Expectations. And inside Great Expectations was Black Beauty. And so my somebody would come in for bed check, like, oh, reading away. And then I had my book in it. David, childhood reading experience. Where was it? What were you reading?
Oh, I read anything I could get my hands on. I remember always on Saturdays walking up to the local library and just spending all day there, finding 2 or 3 books, taking them home, reading them, going back up the next week, find 2 more books, read them. So all I did was read books.
Did you have a little library card that you carried?
I did. Sure did.
Nice.
Yeah, that was a big part of my growing up. And it wasn't, nobody pushed me to it. It just kind of came to me. It's what I kind of enjoyed doing.
Yeah.
And kind of explains a lot about me.
Kyle, childhood reading?
Well, I'm actually a fellow traveler with Catherine. I am dyslexic, and it took me a very long time to learn how to read. I could read-ish, kind of. Mm-hmm. Up until, maybe 3rd or 4th grade is when things kind of actually snapped into place. And people are always kind of surprised when I say that, because they're like, you're a writer, like you literally pay your bills with language. And I think maybe because it was harder, it didn't come naturally to me, that I was more interested in it. It was this thing that I just naturally kind of had some distance to. And so that's why I think I was so fascinated with this code that took me a little longer to crack.
Interesting. So Catherine, did you know at a young age you wanted to write, or do you know at a young age you wanted to be a lawyer? Because you were on the Stanford Law School, honey. As a professor at Vermont, not too shabby. What did you want to be when you were a child?
I wanted to be a tap dancing therapist.
Okay, stop. You had me on tap dancing, and then you added therapist? Tap dancers need therapists?
Right. No, I mean, that was the joke, right? Like, I couldn't decide between being a tap dancer or a therapist, so my parents suggested I combine them. I was writing really early. Like, I was writing really bad poetry when I was really little, and then, you know, continued throughout high school. I mean, really bad poetry.
Okay, wait, you have to follow up that. So a couple of weeks ago, we had Susan Orlean on.
Oh, yeah.
Fabulous. And her first story, which she says the lore, which might be wrong, is at 5. David, what was it? A story about a nearsighted pigeon, right?
So what was your first
poem, Catherine? Do you remember?
Oh, my first poem. You know, I wrote like a short story when I was about 8. And that was about, I remember it so clearly because I had to do the illustrations too. And it was about a gay couple, a white man and a black man, who one of them got AIDS and died. And it was all about coming up with this bigger word for love because love was like too small a word for what they had.
That sounds great.
Intense.
Wrote that at 8?
I was an intense kid. Yeah,
you were an intense 8-year-old.
I was intense. I've always been a bit like that.
I honestly think I probably couldn't read very well at 8. I might have been drawing pictures of a horse with a crayon. That
was I loved horses too, Tori. I loved horses.
That's fabulous. That's why I like you. Okay, so law school, become a lawyer. You taught in a prison, you worked at the Children's Defense Fund, you're a mom of a couple of young children now. Which of these has helped you the most? This is a segue, and I want you to tell us, give us the CNN headlines version of The Uninnocent. Which of these has really helped you or really steered you in the direction of writing this book, The Uninnocent?
Oh man, that's such a good question.
Gotten two of those, David.
I don't know. I mean, in some ways I don't think I really could have written this book until I had become a mother. Both practically and then sort of otherwise, like practically, I think having kids makes you super focused and efficient. And so I would, you know, it's like packing for a trip. It takes up the amount of time that you give it. And I think writing can be like that too. And I had much shorter segments of time to write this book in after I had my son. And so I was really efficient about doing it. But then also, I just don't think that I would have really understood the story here. If I wasn't a mother, I want to walk back from that. I would have understood it differently.
Sure. Yep.
I would have understood it differently. I understand it differently now as a mom. It's not that I wouldn't have understood it. It's just that for me, there was like some threshold that was crossed that really enhanced my understanding of all sides.
Definitely adds layers. Okay. Yeah. Tell us about the story in your own words. Give us the thumbnail sketch of the
Uninnocent. Yeah. So when in 2010, when I just finished my first year of law school, my cousin, who was 16, committed a murder. He killed a child that he didn't know. And the way that it was described to me was that he had a psychotic break. And that's really the only diagnosis that he ever got. It didn't really get more specific than that. And he was tried as an adult in Louisiana and sentenced to life without parole. And so he's serving his life sentence at Angola. And because I was in law school,
there's no good prison, but it's a really
bad prison,
correct?
That's right. Yeah. Angola, I mean, it has a very, very bad reputation. It is better now than it was, but its history is deeply troubled. And some of that surely remains. So anyway, I was in law school at the time. So I think it really impacted what I was understanding about my education and what I was going to do with that education. And then more broadly, I think it also was an event that really changed my understanding of really life, like how, if this is the kind of thing that can happen to you, then that means anything can happen. And we all know that intellectually, but it's really different to really know that in your body, right? You're like going around in your life and you think you're safe most of the time, or some of us have been privileged enough to think that we are safe and the contours of our lives. And then something sometimes can sort of smash that illusion because of course, like we are all eligible for this kind of accident or event or trauma. It doesn't happen to bad people.
Right. There are several wonderful lines, themes, threads, if you will, in the book. One is the criminal justice system. One is that notion of heartbreak. There are many different manifestations of heartbreak. One is forgiveness, rehabilitation. Yeah. Which of those, if any, was the hardest for you to tackle in writing this book?
So I want to say just that the details of the personal narrative were probably hardest. Uh-huh. I felt really resistant to doing it. And remain, you know, I think somebody asked me recently, like, how do you get comfortable with telling this kind of story and publishing it?
Yeah.
And I don't feel comfortable. I still don't feel comfortable really. And so I think that was really difficult to go back into that, the headspace that I was in when this happened and the ways that it affected me and sort of like the way that, because I think one of the things that always troubled me about this on a really hyper personal level was just that I didn't understand why it impacted me so much. I wished that I had been able to just kind of move on. Like, okay, this happened to a cousin. We weren't close. It happened far away from me. You know, like, why did I have to get so, why did it have to kind of grab me in the way that it did? And I don't know that I have an explanation for that, but I certainly have at least like some understanding that I just don't think we choose the events that really impact who we are and the choices that we make. And this was one of mine.
Yeah, Kyle, let me pull you in on this aspect of it. Kyle wrote, for those who don't know, and go back to the top 20, the top original 20 shows, to listen to Kyle on the show, Good Kids, Bad City, A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. Incredible story about guys wrongly convicted in Cleveland. Kyle, what was we talked about it, I'm sure, back then, but the most difficult aspect of that, I mean, you were approaching the story of these guys horribly, horribly mistreated by the system, society, some in the media, et cetera. What was the hardest part for you covering that and writing about that?
Well, there was kind of the immensity of this terrible thing that happened to these men. But really, like writing the book, what was hardest for me was writing it in the first person and bringing myself into the story, because I kind of had to do it because my reporting had been so kind of key to getting them out of jail. And so but I really don't like writing in first person. I don't, you know, I'm a reporter, I'm a journalist. I really avoid that at all times. And I really had to get comfortable with this idea of writing about it. So I was going to ask Catherine if she had written in the first person before, if she had written essays or kept journals or things like that, because I found it really difficult just finding myself on the page and being able to express kind of emotions and thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's enormously challenging. And I think it's really hard to be honest, like on the page. Because your ego is trying to protect yourself even as you're writing. So that's why revision is so important in a process like this, because you just have to go back and be like, okay, like, stop it. You know, stop trying to like make myself sound too good or too bad or, you know, whatever. Like, just be in the middle, be right sized as you're writing, and just be authentic. Like, own the parts of the story that are like, I don't know, more cringy, but I think it is cringeworthy to write about yourself. I think it's really hard to do it in a way that feels good.
Yeah. And I think you pulled it off though really well in this book. And I think that's hard. But one thing I was going to ask, because I really struggled with this, especially when there's a crime or a death involved or some type of violence.
Yeah.
One thing that I was really worried about was kind of taking away the story from the three guys who were wrongfully convicted and the victim. And especially, you know, these were middle-aged African-American men. I'm this, you know, white dude from the suburbs who's 20 years younger than them. I didn't want to appropriate or misappropriate their story. And I feel like, especially when there's a crime involved in violence, that's such a tripwire you have to walk. And I was wondering if you felt that way, especially with the victims' families and your other family members.
Absolutely. And this is this is the central ethical question at the heart of all books like this and journalism, maybe, like, you know, wholesale. The way that I tried to answer the question was to make it my story. So I was like really conscious of not writing somebody else's story because I'm not a journalist. And so I didn't really have to have it be, I didn't have to have it be journalistic in that way. And so it really is focused. I tried to make it really focused on my experience. I don't know that entirely fixes the problem. Like, you know, I still think inevitably you're telling other people's stories because where our stories begin and other people's begin isn't clear, right? Where's that line? Like, still my cousin's story. It still happened to him. It's still his parents' story more than anybody. And it's the victim's family story first and foremost. So yes, by writing about these events, I am quote unquote using them, right? Like we are using things that we write about in a way, but I just kept trying to pull back like to my story, my voice, not telling anybody else's and knowing that everybody kind of had, I think you guys can disagree with me. Tell me if I'm wrong. I think that everybody has a right to their own story and that no event is owned. So unless you're doing like a great deal of harm, that probably there is a way to forge your own path. I don't know though. I may disagree with myself 20 years from now.
No, I think you're right. I think it's really interesting. Kyle, I was looking back at your book, Good Kids, Bad City, and thinking you really did somehow in a remarkably concise way, but you realize it wasn't just these three guys. It was their families. Right. It was their communities, those kinds of things. And you can't help but be aware of the fact that whatever you're writing about, you brilliant people who write, not me, there are other people involved in this. And David, I thought about something and I went back and looked it up and I want to ask you about this.
Yes,
Kobe Bryant died.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote an incredible piece about that and his daughter and the other people who died. And I know you knew him and you knew his family and you knew his friends. You cover wonderfully positive things, but you also cover tragedies like this. Can you think about, or do you have to block out thinking, how is his wife going to see this? How is his, family, his friends, how are they going to feel about this? I believe strongly with Catherine, you, that was a big, big factor.
Yes.
But David, talk about that piece, because it was incredible.
Well, thank you. And so, of course you do, because no matter what I think of Kobe Bryant, as someone who covered him for a long time, he was someone's husband. He was someone's father. He was someone's son. He was someone's brother. And their feelings about him are complicated. Don't get me wrong. They are complicated. They are also none of my business when it comes to this. You know what I mean? So, and that's why it was very hard for me to write about it, because when you talk about Kobe Bryant, inevitably a lot of people want you to focus on the rape allegation against him. I wrote about it. There's no way to transition from that. You can't transition from that back to basketball. I did it inelegantly and people called me on it because there's no good way to do it. But I get coming back to that whatever happened in Colorado, he was still taking his daughter to a basketball game when their helicopter crashed and they both died. Right. And so, so it's hard to write about people whether they're alive or not. It's hard to write about them because we have no sense of who anybody is. Right. You don't know who your spouse is, much less some stranger. Mm-hmm. You don't know who to your point. I mean, I know you weren't close to your cousin, but there was no indication that this was in him. I mean, right? So how could you possibly say, well, we all saw that coming? No, you didn't. Nobody saw it coming. So that's the whole problem when you write about other people. And I think that's why it made sense for you to just say, let me just tell you how this is impacting me. I think that was a good choice.
Yeah.
I think it's really,
go ahead.
I think one thing that came up to me, and this kind of brings it back to the law, is that I feel that just in the last couple decades, or maybe just in the last couple of years,
the law has kind of made this space for victims and victims' families, right? Or at least this, mm-hmm. this acknowledgement, you know, the Olympics coach who went on trial and that powerful scene of all the victims,
Larry Nassar.
Larry Nassar, and having like giving the victims voices. Mm-hmm. What I realized, like reading your book, Catherine, is that there's no space for the families of perpetrators who are often as blindsided and just like, you know, they don't have a say. They don't really, they're just kind of usually people in the corner of a courtroom who everyone's looking at strangely.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And I do think one of the things that I wanted, or that I think about a lot now in terms of policy, is that like until we as a society are willing to acknowledge that there are two parties involved, there's a victim and there's a perpetrator, or, you know, in this case, the person who the murderer, both of those people come from families who are affected. And then both of those people come from communities that are affected. And, you know, we just have to stop thinking so dualistically around innocence and guilt, because that's what kind of undergirds this extreme sentencing, because we don't see perpetrators as people who comes from families who are then living these really, you know, there's just so much shame, you know, think about like, you know, having your family member do this. Anyway,
Catherine, in the book, in your acknowledgments, I think, and then I've also watched a few interviews, you talk a lot about Bryan Stevenson of Just Mercy fame being an inspiration. Bryan Stevenson and his people, by the way, the nicest rejection note I've ever gotten from anyone asking to be on the show. The nicest. It was so nice, but very thoughtful. Just well done. Why an inspiration, and how did your interaction with him and his work affect your thinking about the legal system and rehabilitation and things like life without parole?
Yeah, thanks for that question. He was speaking at the law school, right? So I got back to law school after this crime was committed. And then a few weeks later, he was this speaker at this event that I went to. It was an awards dinner, and he was receiving an award. And I had not been aware of him. I didn't know who he was. This was 2010. And, you know, he's just one of those people that, I'm sure you all know this, like when he got up to speak at the podium, the whole energy of the room changed. Mm-hmm. Like it got really quiet.
That happens when David gets up to a podium. If David gets up to a podium in front of a TV camera, everything stops.
I haven't had enough of this yet.
Some people just have it, right? Some people have that thing.
He has it.
Yes. And Bryan Stevenson definitely does. And that night he was talking about representing these young people who had committed violent crimes. And he said what he's now famous for saying, which is that, you know, he believes that people are more than the worst thing that they've done. We are all more than the worst thing that we've done. And I think there was just, it was like, you know, getting punched in the context of this crime.
Sure.
What my family was going through. I was really primed to hear that message. And he also spoke about like going into dark places and bearing witness to darkness, and that was an important thing to do. And I just, anyway, it offered a lot of possibility to me and a lot of meaning. And he's somebody that I can't like get enough. I try to watch everything that he does and read everything he writes, because I just feel like he is speaking the truth in a way that a handful of people are, you know. And he's just one of the people who is like, he is speaking the truth so clearly. If more people could hear it, I think we would be in a better place.
Yeah. Did your thinking, your approach to various legal issues change over the course of working on this book? So I don't know what they were heading into law school, but whether it's life without parole for juveniles or rehabilitation versus punishment, did your personal views change over the course of doing the work for the book?
I think so in a way, because I one of the things that I struggled with as I was writing was this idea of, so I had a lot of ideals and principles.
Uh-huh.
But I felt like I was an abolitionist basically, like a long time before we were even really talking about that in a larger societal sense. But then when it came to this individual question of my cousin, I didn't really know like what should happen to him, where would he go, and what does he quote unquote deserve? And shouldn't our sympathies lie with the victim's family and this child who'd been taken too soon from the earth, you know? So I wanted, I think the process of the book made me face, it put my principles to the test because I had to wrestle with these questions in the context of particulars. And in the context of particulars that are really, I mean, it's a really harrowing story, this story. Like, it's hard. My cousin, he didn't come from a family where he was abused. He wasn't, you know, under the influence of drugs. Mm-hmm. Like, it really was there, you know, the reason that he got the sentence he did in part is because there were no mitigating factors. And that's one of the things that the sentencing judge looks for. It looks at this young person's life and it says, okay, well, what are these mitigating factors? You know, is he a victim of trauma? Is he, anyway, the point being, it's a hard story for people to sympathize with. It's a hard story for people to sort of like understand. And so I guess the process of writing the book allowed me to really figure out what I believe on an individual level, as well as on a general level. And then, and double down. Like, it turns out that I'm still an abolitionist after this exercise. And it, you know, there's a lot to be uncertain about. I think one of the things that we don't have to be uncertain about is life without parole sentences for juveniles, because even if somebody isn't safe to ever be released from prison, they should be given an opportunity. Like, there's no reason to say when someone's 16 years old that they'll never be, that they'll never change. Right. Like, that is something we can give them a chance. 15 years even, right? Like, I mean, I think it should be much sooner than that. But point being, life without parole is nonsense and unnecessary.
I wonder if you feel kind of despair though at the state of the legal system, having gone through that process and wrestled with those ideals and then come out the other end and seeing what it looks like today?
A bit. You know, I wrote this op-ed in the Washington Post a few weeks ago, and I didn't read any of the comments at the bottom because people told me not to, right?
Never read the comments.
Never read the comments.
Never read the comments.
Please, God, don't read the
comments. So I didn't. I did the right thing, but I did. I know what they were like because people were getting in touch and being like, whoa, you know, like, and I guess this is just to say that it is a rude awakening that so many people, thousands of people, are still advocating for the death penalty. And I think it's easy to get a little divorced from, like, I can get into an echo chamber of people who agree with me right now.
Sure.
In life. And it's a rude awakening. And you guys who are journalists, you know, like, yep, the country is diverse. Like, there are many different opinions about criminal justice, and we are all at different places on that journey. So,
They all have an iPad.
That's the worst thing.
Time.
Take away
lots
that.
Of time.
Lots of time. I know.
Remember back in the dark when I first worked for John McCain on the Hill, the great whatever challenge, the great question, the great whatever in politics was not enough people get engaged, right? Not enough people are involved in politics. Not enough people care. Not enough people go vote. And John McCain used to always go, he'd finish up every event saying, just get out there and get engaged and vote. And I don't care if you vote Republican or Democrat or libertarian or vegetarian. It's just a stupid line. I think a lot of these people should just stop. I think they just need to get
too
many people
just get unengaged. Okay, Catherine, let me, the last serious question I'll ask you is quasi-serious. If you had to do this before you came on, we were talking about David and Kai were talking about the books they'll write when they win the lottery, because they'll write about whatever they want to write about. I will never, ever, ever write a book again because the experience is too tragic. But if you, knowing everything you know now, and you're going to start this process over and start this book again, would you do anything differently?
Oh, why does that question scramble my brain so much? I don't know. I'm too close to it, Tori.
Yeah.
Can I answer you in a couple years? Like, I'll have such a better sense of it.
Absolutely. We'll be on episode 1001 of Chatter on Books. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a great question. And I do appreciate the mental exercise that it
But sometimes it takes a lot of perspective.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. But I'm sure the answer is yes. I just don't know what those things are that I would do differently. But I
just don't ever read the comments between now and when you do that and ask yourself those questions. Okay, a little bit of housekeeping, then we'll get out. Download us, follow us, the usual stuff. Write reviews, because that mean guy still has his review on the top of the list, which makes me very sad on Apple.
Who is it?
What was his name? Horgar or Hagar or whatever?
Yeah, who do we hate? We hate white people or black people. Who is it we hate?
We're just racist, David. You and I are just racist in general.
It was nondescript racism.
Exactly. We are going to come back next week with our probably my favorite show of the year. It's our Thanksgiving family special, Chatter on Books. And we're going to have David and Claude. We're going to have the incomparable Renaissance man, Nevin Martell. My favorite celebrity mixologist, Rodney Ferguson. And we have these crazy authors. I don't know them. Stuart O'Keefe and Amy Phillips, who have written. Did I bring it with me? They've written Cook It. This talk about just sublime to ridiculous after Catherine's book. Cook It, Spill It, Throw It. The Not So Real Housewives Parody Cookbook. The unauthorized version, which means it's really good. And we're going to have them. Claude, thank you for doing all the important work, man. David, Kyle, great to see you. Come back, Kyle.
Absolutely. I'd love to. Thank you so much.
Catherine, be well. Happy Thanksgiving to the whole family, okay?
You too. Thank you, Tori.
Thanks, all right, guys. Thanks for listening, everybody. Stay well. We'll talk soon.